Well, our topic tonight is the life and spirituality of Saint Therese. So it's going to be a wonderful evening where we try to look into the soul of this beautiful saint. So Saint Therese was born in the year 1873, and her baptismal name was Marie-Francoise Therese Martin. Now Pope Pius X called her the greatest saint in modern times. What I'd like to do in tonight's talk is, first of all, describe a little bit about her family background, her parents, her early years growing up, and then talk about a few of the interesting events that occurred in her life. For example, her miraculous cure, her first communion, a special grace she received on a Christmas day, her role in the conversion of, or the repentance of Pranzini, her visit with the Holy Father, her entrance into the Carmel, then a little bit about how she wrote her book, The Story of a Soul, and then talk about her spirituality. So a lot of wonderful things we're going to cover tonight. So first of all, she was born on January 2nd, 1873, in Alençon, France. Now she's the last of nine children. A lot of people don't realize that she had, she was the youngest of nine, but the eldest four children did not survive infancy. Two boys and two girls died at a very young age, only lived perhaps a few months or a few years. Her parents were Louis Martin and Zélie Martin, both of whom are up for canonization right now. So hopefully during our lifetime they'll be beatified and hopefully be declared a saint. Now it's interesting that both her parents had felt an attraction to religious life. They had both felt maybe they were being called by God to enter religious life. In fact, Louis had gone off to become a monk as a young man, but it turned out that it was not his vocation. So he actually became a watchmaker, became very well-to-do and earned quite a good living as a watchmaker. And his wife, Zélie, also tried to become a nun, and she wanted to become a nun to work with the poor, and so she went off to a convent, but she was also told that that was not her vocation. So she left that, and it was really God's divine providence that they were brought together. In fact, the story goes is that they were walking along a walking on a bridge. Louis was walking one way and Zélie was walking the other, and they met crossing the bridge. They were attracted to each other, eventually fell in love and got married. They were married on July 15th in the year 1858, which is a very important year. It's the year, you know, we have the important years of the Marian age with the Miraculous Medal of 1830, the definition of the Immaculate Conception in 1854, and then Our Lady appearing at Lourdes in 1858. This is at the same time Our Lady was appearing at Lourdes, the same year the parents of the Little Flower got married. Now they were both very devout Catholics. Zélie ran a small lace-making business from the home, and they, as you know, were quite well off, well-to-do, and the first four children all died in infancy, but then they had five others. Saint Therese had four sisters that survived. Now, to look at her childhood a little bit, Saint Therese, when she was born, had an intestinal disorder, and so the doctor recommended that if she was going to be able to survive, that she would go off to a wet nurse. And so they sent her off to a farmer's wife, and she grew fat and healthy, as they say. And then she came home after 15 months. So it's interesting that even her health, and even in infancy, was quite delicate. She was described as a young girl as a very charming child by her teachers, but her mother called her a little rascal, called her a little imp, and because she would throw frightful tantrums, and she was very precocious. She was the youngest, so she was shown a lot of attention and affection from her sisters. She was very intelligent as a young girl. She began reading at the age of three, and she was really inseparable from her youngest. The next oldest sister was Celine, and she was inseparable from her. And Therese writes that what she remembers most about her childhood was the smiles of her sisters and the affection that her sisters gave her. Well, as I mentioned, Therese was also quite strong-willed and very impetuous and very much sort of stubborn, I guess we would say. On one particular occasion, her sister Léonie was giving a basket of dolls and ribbons to Céline and Thérèse. So Céline chose like one ball of a yarn, and Thérèse says, she's only like 3 years old, she says, "I choose everything." So she took the whole basket with dolls and materials and just walked off. That was her attitude towards things, that she chose everything. And as we'll see later on, she had a great love for all aspects of the church, in praying for priests and in wanting to serve the church in so many ways. An unfortunate thing happened in her life when Thérèse was 4.5 years old. Her mother, Zélie, died of breast cancer. This was the year 1876. And Zélie died in the presence of her husband, Louis, and then the older girls. Thérèse writes in her autobiography, The Story of a Soul, that she remembers the priest coming to give last rites to her mother. And after her mother had died, her father lifted Thérèse up and she kissed her mother on the forehead, and she remembers clearly her father being so heartbroken and in tears. Well, her father, Louis, was 54 years old at the time. He was heartbroken, so he sold his business and retired, and they moved to Lisieux, which was only about a few hours from Alençon, which was near an aunt, which was near the sister of Zélie, who would also help to raise the children. And so this really began sort of a 9 to 10 year period of shyness and oversensitiveness and many tears on the part of Thérèse. It was also a time when she and her father grew very close. He would call her his little queen, and they would spend time fishing, they would spend time walking in the countryside, they would walk down to the Carmelite monastery and visit the Blessed Sacrament. And so really the first influence on Thérèse's spirituality was that of her father. And her father would teach her the catechism. They would celebrate the feast days at the home by having like extra big desserts and celebration of the feast days. And at this time it was really Pauline, the oldest sister, who became a second mother to Thérèse. She sort of replaced Zélie in the life of young Thérèse. She was only 4.5, 5 years old at this time. Pauline would teach her, prepare her for her first confession, and had a great influence on her as well. In fact, Thérèse made her first confession at the age of 5.5. A lot of people don't realize that. After she did that, well, she would write later on in her autobiography that she says, "When I made my first confession, the Blessed Mother was very pleased with me," she said. After that time, she entered the Benedictine Abbey as a student, and at the age of 8.5, she went to school there. And later on, she would write that this was the saddest years of her life, was being in school. Even though she was intelligent and she was at the top of her class, this particular time in her life was very sad for a few reasons. One, the loss of her mother, then having to move from her hometown to another town, leaving her home. And then at the age of 9, her eldest sister, who was really her second mother, Pauline, entered the Carmel, entered the monastery. And then it was shortly after this, at the age of 10, that Thérèse fell very ill. She had chills, convulsions, fevers, hallucinations. She was crying all the time. She even seemed slipped into a coma. Her condition was so serious that her father even had a novena of masses said for a cure. And on one particular occasion, after Thérèse had been suffering for many months, Marie was by her bedside and her sisters were by her bedside. They were praying to our Blessed Mother. There's a beautiful statue of Our Lady of Grace, Our Lady of the Miraculous Medal. Again, that was 1830. So this statue of Our Lady of Grace was right by the bedside. And the sisters just turned to the Blessed Mother and just pleaded that their little sister would be spared and that she would not die. And Thérèse writes in her autobiography that her eyes fixed upon the statue. And it's a little unclear exactly what happened. Either the statue came to life and was animated, or the Blessed Mother appeared there in place of the statue. It's a little bit unclear. But we do know that Thérèse fixed her gaze upon the statue, and she saw the Blessed Mother smile at her. And she was instantly cured. And she called it Our Lady of the Smile, cured her. And so her symptoms subsided. Marie screamed out, "She's cured! She's cured!" And so Thérèse attributes that cure to the intercession of her Blessed Mother. Now it's interesting, that statue now, if you go to Le Boissonnais in Lisieux, that statue is not actually in the house anymore. That statue was taken by Thérèse when she entered the Carmel, and now where Thérèse is buried at the Carmel, the statue is above her tomb. And this statue would also be present on Thérèse's deathbed. And so it's interesting that statue she was able to bring with her into the Carmel, and she died in the presence of this beautiful statue of Our Lady of Grace. After Thérèse was cured about the age of 10, she continued to be educated at home through this, primarily her sister Marie, because remember, Pauline had already entered the Carmel. So Marie helped to teach her catechism. And so now Marie was helping Thérèse prepare for her first Holy Communion, which she received at the age of 11 or 12, which is sort of late. But remember, this is back in the late 1800s, before Pope Pius X lowered the age of Holy Communion down to about the age of 8, or the age of reason, when he said when a child can distinguish ordinary bread from the body of Christ, then they would be able to receive the Eucharist. And so at this point, though, normally the kids would not receive First Communion until about the age of 11 or 12. So Thérèse was prepared for her first Holy Communion, and it was Pauline, her sister, was writing letters that Thérèse would read to help prepare her for her First Communion. And then on the day of her First Communion, she writes later on that when she made her Holy Communion, it was as if she had the kiss of love, the kiss of Jesus. And she said when she made her First Communion, there was a fusion of souls between her and Christ. And also on the day of her First Communion, she made the act of consecration to Our Blessed Mother. And when she made it with the other children, she was the one who was chosen to read aloud the act of consecration on behalf of all the kids who had made their first Holy Communion. And she says later on that really her First Communion was really the seeds of her religious vocation had begun to grow. And she was confirmed just a few days after that. Confirmation would come just a few days after Holy Communion at that time. Still after her communion, she did struggle with self-doubt, with scrupulosity, with loneliness, with oversensitivity. She left the school that she was in and had a private tutor. And then she received another suffering in her life, and that was when her next eldest sister, Marie, said that she was going to enter the Carmel as well. So she lost her mother, she lost Pauline, and now she was losing Marie. This was a great suffering for Thérèse. And she, at this point, made a resolution to take no pleasure in earthly things from here on out. She said she had been hurt so many times by the things of this world, the mother, her sister, her elder sister entering the Carmel. And so she realized that she had to be detached from the things of this world and from even her own family, and that she was to love God above all things and not to set her heart upon worldly things, but instead to focus on the things of heaven. But then an interesting occasion occurred in the life of Thérèse, and she calls it her Christmas conversion or her Christmas grace. And this is a very interesting event that happened in the life of Thérèse. After Christmas Mass in the year 1886, Thérèse came home from midnight Mass with her family, and it was their practice that they would go to look in their shoes where the father would put presents. And Thérèse was at the top of the stairs, and you know, she was about to come running down to look at her Christmas presents. And she overheard her father telling one of the other sisters, "Well, I'm glad this will be the last time we have to, you know, give Thérèse presents. You know, she'll be grown up by next year." Now her sister realized Thérèse had heard this and was thinking, "Oh no, she's going to break down in tears," because Thérèse would cry at the drop of a hat. During her first really 13 years of life, she was very, very oversensitive and very touchy, and would just cry at the drop of a hat. And so her sister realized, uh-oh, this is going to ruin the Christmas, because Thérèse is going to be bawling in tears, and it's going to, and the father will get upset. Well, Thérèse, at that point, was given a special grace from our Lord, the grace of an inner strength. And she says later on in her autobiography that the work that she had been unable to do in 10 years was done by Jesus in an instant. She was infused with love and with charity, and her selfishness, her self-centeredness disappeared. She said her strength of soul returned, which she had lost at the age of 4.5 with the death of her mother. And she says, charity entered into my heart. And at this point, she began, after this special Christmas grace or Christmas conversion, she began to especially pray for souls. She became very focused on praying for the salvation of souls and the conversion of souls. It's interesting that Paul Claudel, who was an atheist at that time, was in despair, and he was walking down the street in Paris the same time Thérèse received her Christmas grace. Paul Claudel happened to see Notre Dame, the church. So he went in there, and as he heard the beautiful prayers and the Christmas Mass, the Midnight Mass, he was instantly given the gift of faith, and he converted to Catholicism. And so it's interesting, some theologians who have studied the life of St. Thérèse think there could be a connection between the grace she was given and also the gift of faith given to this man named Paul Claudel. Also, 2 weeks later, Charles de Foucauld was converted instantaneously also, just a few weeks after this, after Thérèse started praying for the conversion of sinners. Well, then we move to her teenage years. At this point, after this grace, she continued to grow in her spiritual life. Her scruples and self-doubts diminished. Her love for Jesus and sacrifices increased. And in the year 1887, at the age of 14, she began to increase her spiritual reading. And at this point, she read The Imitation of Christ. One of the most important books in her spiritual life was The Imitation of Christ. In fact, she says she memorized it as she, because this was such an important book for her. The desire to enter Carmel continued to increase. She, at this point, began reading the life of St. Teresa of Avila, who became her spiritual mother. And by reading the life of Teresa of Avila and her books, and also the writings of John of the Cross, the great Spanish mystic, Teresa of Avila and John of the Cross were the ones who really helped to reform the Carmel back in the 1570s. And Thérèse began to really realize what it meant to have a vocation to Carmel, which would mean, leaving the world to help sanctify the world, which would mean a vocation of love, a vocation of hiddenness, a vocation to pray for priests, a life of hidden and humble service to help the sinful world. And so she realized really what the Carmelite vocation was all about. So as she began reading the spirituality, the life of Teresa of Avila and the writings of John of the Cross, her vocation, her attraction towards the Carmel continued to increase, and she had more and more desire to help save souls. So Teresa of Avila really became her spiritual mother at this point. There's a great story in the life of Teresa of Avila when she was going to visit her convents, and she was on horseback, and the horse reared, and fell off the horse and went into the mud. And you know what she told Jesus? She said, "Lord, if this is how you treat your friends, no wonder you have so few of them." Isn't that a classic? That's a great line from Teresa of Avila. Well, at this point in Thérèse's life, a very interesting thing occurred. She had heard about an unrepenting criminal named Pranzini. Pranzini was an Italian who had immigrated to Paris, and he was convicted of murdering a woman, her child, and a maid. He'd cut their throats. And this was in the spring of 1887. And Thérèse heard about this man, Pranzini, who was unrepentant, and he was about to be executed within about a week. And so Thérèse adopted him in prayer and prayed for him constantly each day, made sacrifices for him, even had a mass said, got one of her sisters to have a mass said for a special intention, would not tell what it was. And then, the execution took place. And Thérèse had prayed so much that God would convert this man and even give a special sign that this man had converted, because he would not speak to a priest, he would not go to confession, he was basically had turned his back against Christ and the church. Well, the day after the execution, Therese looked around her father's study to find the newspaper, which she was forbidden to read the newspaper. Her father didn't want her reading the newspaper, but she found a copy of it, and she was able to find the notice about Pranzini's execution. So she read it voraciously to find out if he had repented. Well, it says that just before he had refused the priest, even right before he was to be executed, I believe it was the guillotine. It's a little bit unclear from some of the different accounts, but right before he put his head on the block, he saw the priest holding out the crucifix, and Pranzini reached out, took the crucifix, and kissed it 3 times devoutly, and made an act of sorrow for his sins, and then he was executed. And Therese, in reading that, knew that he had been saved, that he had repented, that he had made a good act of contrition, and she called him my first convert, okay? Her first child of grace. And this really began a whole new ministry or mission for Therese, which was praying for the conversion of poor sinners. So again, she was even more determined than ever to enter the Carmel, but there was opposition from her uncle and from other ecclesiastical authorities because she was only 14 years old and she had to be 16 to enter. The Carmelite authorities said she had to be older. She appealed to the bishop, and when the bishop said no, she says, I'm going to go straight to the top. So she goes to see the Pope. Well, this occurred because her father had already planned a pilgrimage to take her and her other sister to Rome, because Pope Leo XIII was having his 50th jubilee. And so he was Louis Martin was able to arrange a papal audience, and Therese was only 15, and she was able to go in and meet with the Pope, who was very advanced in age at this time. And the people going in were told, whatever you do, do not speak to the Pope. You know, do not talk to the Pope. He's old, he's sickly. And so, of course, Therese talks to the Pope. You know, she goes in line, and right before the Vicar General, the Pope's secretary, tried to move her, she says, Most Holy Father, I have a great favor to ask you. In honor of your jubilee, permit me to enter Carmel at the age of 15. Well, the Pope was very kind, and I guess the secretary sort of translated for him, and he basically said, you know, to follow the proper authorities, and if it's God's will for you to enter, you will. And then, of course, the Swiss guards had to usher her out. They showed her the door, as they say. Yeah, I remember reading that one comedian said, you know, it's amazing how the Swiss Army ever won any battles. All they use is those little Swiss Army knives. Yeah, imagine somebody coming at you and all you pulled out is a little fork or a little corkscrew or a little knife. It's amazing how those guys win any battles. So anyway, she had to be ushered off by the Swiss guards. And then, but you can tell here her will of iron. You know, when the authorities said, you know, she couldn't enter the Carmel, the bishop said no, she said, well, I'm going to go straight to the top. And after she returned home, some time went by, and she was granted permission. And so she entered the Carmel on April 9th during the Easter season in the year 1888, looking at the crucifix. And her last words were, oh, I love him. My God, I love you. And so she died at the age of 24. And after she died, she in the year 1910, her body was exhumed on September 6, 1910, and it had disintegrated. Some people say, well, why isn't she incorrupt? Well, Therese predicted that she would not be corrupt. She predicted that she would not be incorrupt. I hope I said that right. In other words, she knew that she would decay. Okay, she knew that she would not remain incorrupt, but that, you know, she did predict many other things. Now, when she died basically in obscurity, but later on when they moved her body back into the Carmel in the year 1914, when her cause was introduced, over 50,000 pilgrims attended the ceremony where they carried her body back into the Carmel. And she was beatified in 1923 on April 29th, 1923, by Pius XI, was canonized in 1925, And it's interesting to note that all four of her sisters were still alive when Thérèse was canonized. And so even though they were cloistered and could not attend the ceremony, I'm sure it was a great joy for them to have their little sister, little Thérèse, canonized. And she was canonized only 28 years after her death, which was, you know, quite quick. She was declared in 1927 to be the patron saint of the missions with Francis Xavier, and she is also the patron saint of Russia, the Church's work for converting Russia. Saint Pius XI, Pope Pius XI, called her a master of the spiritual life, and her confessors said that they believe she never committed a mortal sin during her life, which was, again, quite impressive. And her canonization, there were over 60,000 people that attended her canonization. So at that point, I think we'll stop and then we'll take a little break, and then we'll come back and have you have a chance to ask some questions. There's a little bit more about her spiritual childhood that we could get into, about what exactly that means, and also maybe a little bit more about this trial of faith that Thérèse endured. But I think we'll stop here for a moment, take a break, and then come back and have you ask some questions. Okay, before we take some questions, I want to pass around this first-class relic of St. Thérèse. And this reliquary is unique because inside the crucifix, there are three relics. They're all first-class relics. And St. Louis de Montfort, St. Pius X, that we talked about, who really considered The Story of a Soul is one of his bedside reading books. He kept it on his bedstand, and he was greatly influenced by St. Thérèse. In fact, they say it's one of the reasons why he lowered the age of Holy Communion from about 11 or 12 down to about 8 because of her. So I'll pass this around. You're welcome to look at it and venerate it if you'd like. Also, I'll explain a few things about this. The pictures that we have here, this picture is St. Thérèse at the year, ages 8 years old. Okay, this one here, it's a beautiful picture of her. This is her when she's 15, and notice she puts her hair up. Kate and I were talking about that. She put her hair up to try to look older when she would talk to the bishop and the pope, so she didn't look quite as young. And this is her, I believe she was 22 in that picture, if I'm not mistaken, a few years before she died, if I'm not mistaken. Also want to mention, this book is called I Believe in Love. See, in my last parish, I had a Book of the Month Club, just like Oprah, okay? And every month we got together and we would read a different book during the course of the month, and then we'd get together once a month for about an hour and 20 minutes and discuss it. And we read the De Montfort's True Devotion, we read The Imitation of Christ, we read The Story of a Soul. And this is one of the books I picked. This is one of the most beautiful books I've ever read on the spirituality of St. Thérèse. It's 10 retreat conferences on things like confidence, humility, love, the Eucharist, and a few other topics. So I'd highly recommend this book, Abandonment to Divine Providence, the Cross, Humility, Love, Confidence, and the Apostolate. So that's a very good one. So we'll have time for some questions now, whoever wants to ask any questions. This is called I Believe in Love by Pierre D.L.D. I have 5 copies here. If anybody wants them, I'd be happy. You're welcome to take those tonight if anybody wants them. Yeah, Michelle.
Could you please repeat again the two, you mentioned two titles, the first one, Joseph Priest.
Okay, the major influences on her spirituality was The Abandonment to Divine Providence by De Caussade, a Jesuit. And the other one was The True Devotion to Our Lady by Louis de Montfort. Now, she never mentions either of these books by name, but these spiritualities were very prevalent by the 1870s, 1860s, 1870s. Since de Montfort's book was rediscovered, I think, in 1842, and de Caussade's book was also quite well known at that time. That's a good question. The other questions on St. Thérèse and her spirituality.
She also wrote poetry. her poetry book is up on the table too, and that's beautiful.
Yeah, Therese has a beautiful poem about the Blessed Mother that she wrote, and wrote a number of other poems. And so besides her story of a soul, we also have her last conversations, which have been published, and then her poetry as well. And this book is interesting because you can see her actual, it's a photograph of her actual handwriting. So you're welcome to have some nice pictures in here. You're welcome to pass this around. I read this for the first time in the seminary back a long time ago, back 1980. I was in seminary from 86 to 1990, so 1986 I probably read that for the first time. Yeah.
Also, she wrote plays. She did Joan of Arc.
Yeah, there's a good picture, I think it's in here, of her doing Joan of Arc in the convent, and the nuns loved it.
Yeah, she got the nuns all dressed up, and it was,
yeah, that was,
everybody acted.
That was one of her patron saints, was Joan of Arc, patron saint of France. Yeah, Terry.
I was thinking how a lot of the saints seem to go through the divinity in prayer, you know, in a prayer like in a belief or something, or that they persisted, nevertheless, in prayer, even though they didn't have that feeling.
Yeah, exactly. One of the keys to the saints is perseverance, despite aridity in prayer, despite lack of feeling any consolation. She did persevere. And one thing she would keep in her Gospels was the Apostles' Creed. And she would often read and reread the Apostles' Creed when she was having doubts of heaven. So she certainly did persevere in prayer. Many of the saints went through that. See, there's different stages of the spiritual life. You know, you have for example, the unitive stage is the final stage. There's also the purgative stage and the illuminative stage. So oftentimes, many times when these souls are going through their difficulties, they're going through the purgative stage of being purified. But even oftentimes in the transforming union or the unitive way, as they say, Therese was always at peace, even during her difficult times of suffering. She does say she was always had inner peace and inner joy, even though she was given this trial of faith. And it's believed that when she offered herself as a victim of love, that, you know, she knew and she predicted the apostasy and the lack of belief in God that would occur in the next century. And she offered herself as a victim to make up for that. But she did persevere during the times of dryness and aridity. Yeah, Michelle?
What exactly is it about her writings or her designation
for her as a doctor? Okay, a great question about Therese being declared a doctor of the church, which actually Therese said when she was younger that, you know, she had a great desire to do everything. She chose a basket of dolls. She says, "I choose everything." So Therese wanted to become a missionary. She wanted to become a priest, even though she knew that wasn't possible, wasn't a vocation. But she had that desire to be an apostle, to be a doctor of the church, to be a teacher, an evangelist, basically to be a martyr. She had the desire to be a martyr, but not just a martyr once, but a martyr many times, to experience every kind of martyrdom out of love for Jesus. So it's interesting that she did desire to become a doctor of the church. Now what we see in the story of a soul and why she became a doctor of the church, declared just last year by Pope John Paul II, was first of all, to be a doctor of the church, your writings have to be orthodox, and you have to be a saint, first of all. Your writings have to be without error. They have to be orthodox, in line with the teachings of the church. And then your writings have had to exercise a great influence on the church. And even though she really only has one book and then some poetry and some, like, last conversations, even though she really only wrote, we could say, one book, that book has had such a widespread influence on the whole church that the Holy Father declared that she can truly be called a doctor of the church, because her spirituality has been so popular and so pervasive throughout the whole church.
There are only three women who are doctors of the church. She's one of three. Teresa of Avila and Catherine of Siena.
Catherine of Siena, Teresa of Avila, and now St. Therese.
There are about 33 or 34 doctors.
Yeah, I believe it's about 33 male doctors of the church.
Yeah. They're all men except for these three women.
So the women are catching up. Because St. Therese was the last one. And I think it's also important that because she's the youngest doctor of the church, 24 years of age, and I think the Holy Father wants her as a role model for our young people and as an example. And in fact, he announced, I was there in the crowd in Paris for World Youth Day when he announced that he was going to declare her a doctor of the church. He announced it at World Youth Day to have her really be the patron saint of youth, but then he, of course, in Rome was when it officially took place.
There's a book out to St. Therese for today, and that really is bringing her into the everyday life of today. She was really way ahead of her time.
Exactly. Yes, she certainly was. Yes, she was a unique person. Okay, Kelly.
Did she endure her trial of faith internally, or did she externalize and seek her help through her spiritual director or the prioress?
Yeah, it's a very good question about Therese's spiritual directors. And so we just experienced a little bit of the dark night of the soul. When those lights went out just like that, you know, you can imagine what her trial of faith was like to live in that darkness for a year and a half. It must have been St. Therese doing that for us. I'm glad you brought up the question about her spiritual directors because she had a very difficult time finding a spiritual director. In fact, she never really had one. I mean, she would have a regular confessor, Carmelites that would come in to hear confessions, but it seems that Jesus himself loved her so much that as some of the priests, in fact, Father Fred Miller, who's a friend of mine, he did this four-tape series on the life and spirituality of St. Therese, which I listened to this past week. And so I basically, anything good I said tonight was all from him, okay? I boiled down the four tapes into about a 45-minute summary. But this goes through her life, the sources that influenced her, like the books, and her trial of faith. He has a whole tape on her trial of faith, another tape on her devotion to the Blessed Mother. So I do highly recommend that if you're interested, you could listen to this set of tapes and get deeper into her spirituality. But one thing he says is that Jesus had a holy jealousy of Therese and was her own spiritual director. So Therese's director was really Jesus. And so she would go to Jesus with her problems because she really couldn't find an earthly director. And Father Miller says it's because Jesus had this real possessive love for Therese and was jealous and wouldn't let her go to anybody else. Yeah, Teresa.
Are there any books written on her miracles
to? I'm sure that there is actually many biographies of Therese, and I think quite a few of them include miracles through her intercession. Actually, the book I forgot to bring tonight was the St. Therese photo album. Have you seen that? It's a beautiful book. I should have brought it tonight because it goes through all the original photographs that were taken and blows them up and shows you how some of them were later retouched, you know, to make her look maybe a little different. Yeah, Tui.
I had the opportunity to browse through. I didn't read the book, but I had the history of the song.
Right. Right. Yeah, The Story of a Soul is one of the greatest books of all time in the history of Christian spirituality, without a doubt. How many of you have been to Lisieux over in France? Has anybody been there? Okay, only one of you. Hey, y'all have to go, okay? That's part of the field trip from the old ed. Has to go over there. You know, when you go, what you can visit there, you can visit her house, Le Boissonnais. In fact, I've been there a couple times, and I should have brought my photo album because I could show you the house. In fact, next week I'll bring it. I'll bring my photo album. And you can see the beautiful house that she had. I mean, her family was very, pretty well off. I mean, the furniture was beautiful, either cherry or mahogany. I mean, the house was just immaculate. And then if you go into the backyard, there's this beautiful statue of Saint Therese on her father's knee, asking permission to enter the Carmel. And there's so you can go back and walk in her backyard. And inside her house, you can see her bedroom where she had been miraculously cured by our Blessed Mother. You can see her kitchen, dining room, living room. And then they have a number of her things, like her first communion dress, her little teacup that she used to play, her dolls. And has anybody been to Darien, Illinois? There's a shrine there of St. Therese in Darien, Illinois. You've been there? They have quite a few of her relics as well, some of her children's books and dresses and things. So
that's our Carmelite headquarters.
Exactly, Darien, Illinois. That's closer than France, so everybody can get there. So that's worthwhile. So in Lisieux, so you can go there to the Boissonnais, which is the house, and then you can go to the Carmel, to the convent itself, where she lived for 9 years. And there, if you go into the Carmel, on the right-hand side, she's behind glass, and she's in a glass coffin. And also buried there are her, I believe, her other three sisters that died there at the Carmel. And a lot of people think she's incorrupt, but she's not. But there is a statue of her there, and her remains are basically underneath that statue. But it looks very realistic. If you look at that, if you look at St. Bernadette, you really couldn't tell which one was incorrupt and which one wasn't. A lot of people think she is incorrupt, but she's not. And then if you go to the Basilica, which was dedicated, I believe, around 1925, soon after she became a saint, they have a beautiful picture of her father and mother. They're buried around back, behind the Basilica. And then also, they have a relic of St. Therese in the Basilica, her arm, her right arm. Okay, her right arm is there, her body's down the street. So she's... And then you can also go to the church, I believe it's called St. Peter's, which is within walking distance. That's where she made her first Holy Communion and where she attended Mass with her father. Yeah, Ruth?
Did you mention that she went to confession when she was 5 and a half?
Yes, she made her first confession age 5 and a half. Until 11 or 12. So she had waited about 6 or 7 years. That was the teaching back then, is that kids did not make communion early. And so Pope Pius X lowered that to about the year 1903, 1910. He lowered that to about age 8.
Well, what about confession? Did children go to penance when they were younger?
Yeah, they did have penance earlier at that time.
Oh, yes, they did.
Right. Yeah, they were going to regular confession for years before they could make their first communion. Yeah.
And she prayed for priests all the time. She wanted to be a missionary herself.
She did. Yes. And that's why she's declared the patron saint of the missions with Francis Xavier, even though she never left the walls of her convent. So she had the heart of a missionary, the heart of an apostle, the heart of a martyr.
Some of them, I think, were going to Saigon at one time, weren't they?
Some of the Carmelites?
Yeah. She
yeah.
To go to
That's right. That's right. She did wish to do that.
Tell us about her father and mother. They're venerable now.
Right. Her parents are venerable. So I believe they're just waiting a miracle, proven miracle through their intercession before they can be beatified. And then, of course, one more miracle for canonization. But it's beautiful when you go to the Basilica around back, they have their tombs, their graves. And it's very interesting. It's well worth the trip over there. No, she was the youngest of 9 children, and the first 4 children born were 2 boys and 2 girls, and they all died in either infancy or in the first couple years. And then she had five herself and 4 sisters, Pauline, Marie, Leone, and Celine, I believe in that order, if I'm not mistaken. Let me just mention one or two things about her, just for another minute, about her spiritual childhood. One of her points was that she always wanted to be able to, like, to sit on God's knee. She always wanted to become small, like a little child. She loved calling God Abba. And the little way, which is really what she's well known for, was a way of trust, a way in which she could be humble, and a way in which she could come to Jesus. Like Jesus says, let the little children come unto me, for the reign of God belongs to them. Now, this little way means that that you would worry about nothing. You have to trust in God, and that you want to have a life pleasing to God, and that do everything out of love for Him, like a little child with great confidence in the Heavenly Father. Also not to be discouraged by sin, you know, not to let that get in your way, and do the ordinary things of your daily duty with great love. So it's really the little way. Now it's interesting, elevators were just coming into invention at that time. They were just being invented. So Therese called her little way the elevator to God. You know, something where God just picks you up and takes you to Himself instead of climbing the stairway of perfection that way. You see, Therese was always realized that the best way to be close to Jesus is to be carried by Him. So to be carried by Jesus, you have to be little so He can take you in His arms. And so the little way was a way of becoming very childlike, very humble, very simple, so that Jesus can carry you spiritually. And so she said she was always reluctant to do like severe penances and very, very big things. But she says, I don't have to do those things. A little child can only do little things. So she would just do the little things. Plus, it makes a lot of sense because sometimes the big penances, if somebody does them, can make them feel proud, which defeats the whole purpose. But if you only do little things out of love for God, then, you know, it can keep you humble. Any questions on the spiritual childhood?
She suffered quite a bit. That was really a big penance. Didn't she have a big, real huge leg at one time?
Yeah, she suffered quite a bit physically and spiritually. And the tuberculosis, she basically probably had tuberculosis the last 3-4 years of her life, but the symptoms came out about 2 years before the end of her life. And she had, for example, her hearing became very hypersensitive, so if somebody, you know, made a loud noise, it hurt her quite a bit. Also, she describes being in bed as laying on a bed of nails. So her skin became very sensitive. But she would unite this to the sufferings of Christ and offer it up for souls. So as Father Miller says, even though she died physically of tuberculosis, St. John of the Cross says that the souls in this transforming union, in the spiritual marriage with Jesus, die of love. Die of love for God and love for souls.
Loved Scripture very much. She quoted it so much in her writing. She knew it.
She did.
Even though it was difficult to get books and everything at that time.
That's true. Yeah, she always carried the Scriptures with her. And at one point about when she received the wound of love, now that was very interesting because that was one of the few mystical experiences. So she always prayed that she would not have a lot of mystical experiences. She just wanted to have ordinary faith. But this is very interesting. When she received that wound of love in June of 1895, which just lasted for a moment, but you know, she was sort of touched by the hand of God at that point. Yeah, Duke.
Yes, sir. I'm not sure whether she had a lot of faith during certain moment of her life. She lost some faith in God.
Well, according to everything I've read and what I've studied, she never lost her faith. In fact, whenever she was tempted not to believe in heaven or that heaven was for her or that she could get to heaven, she would always make an act of faith. That's why she had the creed in her Bible. She would always reaffirm her faith. Because, you know, faith is not of the emotions, it's an act of the intellect, assenting to the truths revealed by God. So whenever she was tempted in this way, which could have been, you know, one of the temptations of Satan to try to lead her away to despair, perhaps, or it could have been just a sharing in the agony that Jesus endured on the cross. Remember when He says, my God, why hast thou forsaken me? Many of the theologians would say that not only was He quoting Psalm 22, but Jesus willingly allowed Himself to experience the guilt of all the human race in the Garden of Gethsemane by taking upon Himself the sins of all mankind. He took the sin and the guilt of every sin ever committed, even the sin of atheists. And on the cross, when he said, my God, why hast thou forsaken me? Jesus allowed himself to experience this total desolation, this feelings of what the atheist feels like. And so apparently Therese had a share in that she also experienced what the atheist would experience, but she, from what I've read, always remained still at peace, still had the interior joy, but that she never apparently doubted any of the doctrines of the faith or the existence of God or the existence of Jesus, but it was mostly about heaven that she had the difficulty with, either thinking that she wouldn't get there or just not being able to grasp that. Okay, yeah, Betty.
I saw a wonderful play on the story of my soul, or the West Back a year or so ago by St. Luke's production, done beautifully by this Italian Leopold.
Oh, yeah.
And a wonderful girl from Iowa who was the actress. Oh, wonderful. Maybe we could get that.
That'd be excellent. In fact, I have seen that same actor has done like Maximilian Kolbe, I think, and maybe Damien the Leper and St. Francis of Assisi as well.
Right.
Oh, very good. Okay, any final questions? Any last questions or comments about St. Therese?
I want to mention something. There's a very young lady here tonight, very young lady, who is going to be confirmed. And you want to stand up?
Aaron.
And she's taking the name of Therese for her confirmation.
Very good.
So, Therese, you're going to get the roses tonight.
Oh.
Okay.
Oh, very good. That's excellent. Okay, very good. Anybody else? Any other questions? Yes.
I was just wondering that before Teresa died, she said that there was no fear. She's not afraid of her death. So I was wondering that for majority of people, like this, they have certain kind of fear because they seem like they are sinners, and they didn't live a worthy life. There's certain kind of fear, but there was no fear with the same priest. So I just wonder why is it? I mean, why some people, even the holy people,
don't feel any remember when Pope John the 23rd was dying, I guess there was something about, you know, him being afraid, and people were wondering, you know, how could that happen? How could a pope, you know, be afraid of death? And I'm sure all of us are afraid of death in some way or another, at least maybe how we might die or the judgment. But St. Therese, I don't notice anything, I haven't found anything in her writings or the commentators about whether or not she was afraid. I haven't noticed that in her writings, just that that she, you know, did experience this real desolation and spiritual darkness. But the last few moments of her life, she was, this darkness was lifted, and she experienced great joy and peace, and she had a beautiful smile on her face when she died. So at the last moment, This darkness did lift. Okay, next week, well, as you know, this Sunday is the feast day of St. Francis of Assisi.
Right.
Okay. Anybody like the Franciscans? Okay.
Anyone like to join the Third Order?
Okay, good.
Saturday each month over the Lyceum Hall, across from the rectory of St. Mary's Church.
Good. So there's the Carmelites tonight and the Franciscans next Thursday. What I'm going to do is I'm going to, for next Thursday, but because the feast day of St. Francis is this Sunday and it falls on a Sunday, so we don't get to celebrate it, unfortunately, liturgically, I'll do the talk next week on St. Francis and the Franciscan spirituality, and then talk about some of the other great Franciscan saints, maybe St. Anthony and St. I think there's like a St. Louis the Ninth, I think, is, I believe, a Franciscan. I'm just teasing. He's our patron saint. He's our patron saint of our parish. So I'll talk about him and maybe a few other interesting Franciscans as well. So next week is Franciscan spirituality. Okay, thanks for being here tonight, everybody.
Thank you, Father.